This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's find out what the latest is involving the efforts to make sure that the Amtrak Hoosier State and the Cardinal Lines and all the other passenger rail service that run through Indiana, and particularly through Northwest Indiana, will keep on keeping on as the new two-year state budget goes into effect after legislators pass it. Let's turn to Steve Coxhead. He's president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance for the latest. And Steve, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, let's see what the latest is. You have an update here, I guess, on Amtrak service and Amtrak in general. Fill us in on what the latest is on this service that we depend on that run trains from Chicago to Indianapolis and also all the way through through Indiana, for that matter, too, all the way into Ohio.
Well, right now that you have that route that goes diagonally through the state, entering northwest Indiana up here in Dyer, and going down through Lafayette, Indianapolis, exiting the state into Cincinnati, and in some cases on to D.C. and New York. 3 days a week we have the Amtrak-funded Cardinal, okay, which originates in New York. The other 4 days of the week we have the state of Indiana-funded Hoosier State, which runs only between Indianapolis and Chicago. Right now, things actually look fairly bad. The budget as sent down by the governor did not have any funding for the Hoosier State, which means as of June 30th, I think it will be discontinued. Budget went into the Indiana House. There was an attempt made to restore funding for the Hoosier State in the House. It was voted down, we believe, on a pretty much a party line basis. The budget then moved to the Senate. It is still in the Senate. There is some work being done behind the scenes with some senators from the western edge of the state to try to get the funding restored. But we don't yet know how that's going to turn out. We do know that the budget will have to be passed by the end of April, by law, and that's when the session is due to adjourn. So right now we're fighting a last-ditch effort to have the Indiana Senate restore some funding. It is somewhat distressing, as this is a case where the Governor Holcomb made a decision to simply delete funding from the state budget. And this wasn't an accident or done because he didn't understand about rail. For reasons of his own, he simply deleted it. Now, what we have here with the Hoosier State, it's kind of circular reasoning. Right now, you have one train in each direction each day, which means you can come up from Indianapolis and get back in the same day, but you cannot go down to Indianapolis and get back in the same day. Everyone concerned understands that under those conditions, you're not going to get enough ridership to make the thing economically viable. It's well known, and our organization has been saying it for a long time, that you need two and more likely three trains each day in each direction to generate ridership for the service to be viable. Now, what the governor, the approach taken, the governor said, well, the service we have with, you know, one train each direction each day doesn't generate enough riders, so it's worthwhile. When you come back and say, well, yes, we understand that, you have to have a couple more trains to generate enough riders to pay for the service, the governor says, well, he doesn't want to spend more money. And why don't you want to spend more money? Well, because the ridership is low. Well, the ridership mm-hmm. will only go up if you spend more. I think some of us remember the old movie Catch-22. Use this terminology. So that's basically where we are right now. We had originally been given to believe that there was support in the General Assembly for the same support that we had in the last budget. We had started to push for an increased level of support to double the number of trains. And we had gone into the budget session with the understanding that there was support in the General Assembly, and then it turned out the budget that came out of the governor's office had this large hole in it. So that's basically where we are right now. Current support for the Hoosier State would be $6 million spread over 2 years. Doubling that to 12 would give us two or three trains a day. Now, by comparison, the Indiana state budget is something on the order of $33 billion. So what we're looking at here is pocket change. In fact, it truly is much smaller than the amount allocated to mowing the grass along the interstate highways on an annual basis. So that's where we are. We are trying to fight, and truthfully, Chris, we're not trying to preserve what is admittedly a bad service. We're trying to preserve the concept of service, and what we really want is to improve it so that it becomes something that Indiana and everyone else concerned can be proud of and, you know, does not require endless subsidies. But that's going to be very hard to do if the service goes away. I think there will be a press. I think Amtrak has sent a letter to INDOT, as it's required to by law, indicating it will suspend the service in 90 days. And I believe there is an. I believe there will be an Amtrak press release coming out today, although I haven't seen it yet, to the same effect. So that's basically where we are, and it sets a bad precedent. We're still trying to get our Chicago to Fort Wayne to Columbus, Ohio service off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to see how the state would support that if they won't support the existing service from Chicago through down to Indianapolis. So it's very difficult, very frustrating right now. We're hoping the state of Indiana can move forward, but it seems reluctant to do so.
Is there any one in particular that you folks with the Passenger Rail Alliance have been trying to lobby with to get support and get something done? Like you say, we do at least have one version of the budget that's still unaccounted for, I guess, and you want to find out if it's going to at least make it over to another. And we know that the measures have to move out of one house into another and get passed pretty soon if it's going to happen before the end of the month when the session is officially over.
Well, you know, we've been basically trying to approach all the senators right now. You know, the Republican Party leadership, you know, which is where control lies, is pretty much following the line laid down by the Republican governor. You know, whether you're Republican or Democrat, you know, liberal or conservative, we have a state government that's basically controlled by the Republican Party. And so it's very difficult for legislators to actively buck the party's position, you know, on a given issue. And I could say that about any issue. It's not just transportation.
Right.
That's what we're trying to fight right now. We have people in the legislature who are sympathetic and who think it's a good idea, but to go from there to actively opposing their party leadership is another matter. You know, if we could get a lot of people to contact their state senators, maybe contact the state governor, and indicate that this is a service that needs to be preserved and built upon, there's still a possibility that, you know, that it could change things. A lot of times, you know, politicians at all levels of government, if they get enough input from the grassroots, you know, they'll have a come-to-Jesus meeting, so to speak, and say, oh, you know, I've been wrong on this. Maybe I should change my mind. So that's what we're working on now, to try to get as many people as possible to, you know, just drop a quick email, a quick phone call. And, you know, it doesn't have to go into long, logical or business case things. You know, just a very brief statement. Look, we have the service. We need to preserve it. We need to increase support and make it, you know, into a really good service. If enough people do that, the budget is still fluid until the final day.
Right. And I know that we know that the governor's budget plan is not cast in stone. It is one of these things that could shift around here, I guess. But here again, I can understand where if you have a supermajority, as the General Assembly has from the Republican Party, it's going to be very difficult to convince a lot of people to make the changeover if they haven't done so. And they probably don't, unfortunately, care one way or the other what Amtrak does.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Amtrak is the only game in town for the moment. Although I do have to say that it is certainly possible for the state of Indiana to contract with some other carrier, and there are other carriers in the world, to provide rail service. Amtrak is not the only game in the town if you take the long view. you know, it's been suggested that, well, maybe what NDOT needs to do, as opposed to dropping the service in this budget, they simply need to put out another RFP. It would be a request for a proposal, and see if other carriers, primarily private carriers, are interested in having another go at it.
You get the impression that that maybe NDOT is a little wary of the process because of the problems with Iowa Pacific Holdings and the fact that they had somebody that was going to run the service and actually did for a while and suddenly dropped out of it?
Yeah, I'll tell you, frankly, Chris, you know, the problem with Iowa Pacific, when you really dig down into it, was pretty much with Iowa Pacific, not with the concept. And I would say right now, the problem is not with NDOT. You know, NDOT has actually done a lot of groundwork that would prepare the way for really improving the service. And, you know, they have moved from a position, I would say, over the last 3 or 4 years of being actively hostile to being really quite enthused about the idea. The problem really, you know, policy is not made in NDOT, you know, and the problem is higher up at the political level where the policy is being made. You know, NDOT is following the direction they've received from the commissioner and from the governor. That's why we keep coming back to the idea that it's really a political problem, not a technical problem. I would say, as far as we can tell, if the funding were there, NDOT would be able to do some truly interesting things with this service.
Well, I know, you guys, we know if the Hoosier State was able to stay alive long enough that that they'd be able to not only make more runs to Indianapolis. And you say the interesting situation is that you can take a train down from here to Indy, but you can't get back up here within the same day. And that's probably something that maybe most people have no idea about. They are so used to driving, and if they want to take the train for the convenience and the flexibility that they could possibly have if you had more trains.
Yeah, and I was down in Indianapolis Saturday for a meeting. I had to drive down because I couldn't get there and back on the same day, you know, on the train. Mm-hmm. And well, you know, it went well, you know, but it was more than a 3-hour drive each way, and so there was nothing I could do but drive my car for 6 hours out of the day. You know, there's a lot of times, especially if you're traveling on business, where it would be nice to be able to do something with that transit time other than operate an automobile, like review notes or put together proposals, you know, and so forth. And also, I've taken 5 and 6 hours to get down to Indianapolis when there's been weather or traffic-related problems. So, yeah, you know, if the train actually adds, the training combined, you know, with the surface roads actually adds an element of stability and reliability. But you've got to have enough trains each day, you know, so that it becomes practical.
Now, I know that if for some bad reason, if it turned out to be that way, that if the public funding for the Hoosier State were to disappear and not be in the budget for 2 years, I guess there would still be some connection by rail to Chicago. But here again, I guess it's relying on the Cardinal Line doing all the work, isn't it?
Right. And the Cardinal is only 3 days a week. It originates in New York City. So its on-time performance record is not the best. By comparison, the Hoosier State's on-time performance, since it originates in Indianapolis, has been between 80% and 90% recently. And of course, with the Cardinal, you've only got 3 days a week, so it's really not a convenient schedule for traveling in and through Indiana. And of course, that's the thing. If you know, the people who control the funding are going to say, well, the service has to at least make enough money to cover its costs, well, mm-hmm. then you have to have a schedule that makes sense for the area being served, you know, which in our case would be Indiana. So that's the battle we're fighting. Everyone admits that we've got a poor service, you know, that really doesn't cover its costs, but also everyone knows that, I wouldn't say everyone, those who have looked into these things know that the service has to be improved before you can realistically talk about it covering its cost.
Now, you mentioned a little bit here about Amtrak's view on this and what they would like to at least try to do if they can get the service. But they probably would rely on the service not only for carrying passengers from one point to the other, but they probably want to take advantage of the service so that this way they could actually get their own equipment around, isn't it? And the reason I think of that is because Amtrak has this very large facility in Beech Grove, which is on the south side of Indianapolis, one of the little suburbs of Indianapolis. That handle all these trains and all the equipment that come through.
Right. It's the only heavy maintenance facility west of the Appalachian Mountains, actually. So it's a key part of the Amtrak system. Yeah, they do a lot of heavy maintenance, a lot of repair, a lot of reconstruction. And I think, don't quote me because I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but I think that facility employs about 300 to 400, at least, skilled craftsmen. So it's a source of very well-paying jobs in that area.
Well, Steve, we're just going to have to keep an eye on what lawmakers do here in the next 3 weeks or so in making their decisions on the budget and the like. And I guess it's all that anybody can do is maybe get hold of the governor's office and lobby hard with the governor if they want to see something done.
Yeah, a call to the governor's office or a call to whichever state senator serves your county, your district, might actually do perform miracles.
That's Steve Coxette is president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. And Steve, thanks for being with us today to talk about it.
Thank you very much, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Shared Ethics Advisory Committee recently held its annual ethics summit at the Avalon Manor in Hobart, and some interesting comments made probably the most interesting comments made by the keynote speaker in the event. Let's turn to Dan Klein. He's a member of the Shared Ethics Advisory Committee. And Dan, thanks for joining us today on the program.
No, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start first to find out in particular what some of the main topics that were brought up in the recent ethics summit were, and how the keynote speaker, the man we're talking about in particular, is U.S. Attorney Thomas Kirsch, what he had to say that fit in all this, too. He always has something good to say.
He sure does, and he did, that's for sure. First of all, the Ethics Summit, which is a yearly event that the Shared Ethics Advisory Commission puts on, always has a keynote speaker. And the first thing we do is try to introduce the crowd to the Shared Ethics Advisory Commission to let them know what we do on a yearly basis. And so that really consists of, and one of the things that's happening right now is the pledge that we ask candidates to take or to sign, saying that if they get in office, they're going to provide ethics training to their electorate or their organization, whether it's a town council, city council, whatever it might be,
yeah,
that they're part of. So that's going on right now. Those names will be published in the next couple of weeks, right before the election, just so people can see who signed the ethics pledge and who did not. And hopefully that will sway people in regards to their vote. The next thing that we did and we're in the process of is every 3 years we do a ethics survey. So we go to all of the 24 member communities and we ask those employees to take this survey and how... how the training they received, you know, how is it good, is it bad, is it different, how we can judge where we need to tweak things as we move forward each year, because we do provide training as well. So those were the two main topics that we wanted to get across. And then the third one was the fact that we're going to have department head training in the fall of this year, where we provide key people in an organization, just like a private company would do. We provide department heads training on, you know, things that they might come across and how to deal with specific issues.
I suppose that's probably the most important, because you may have the elected officials who, of course, are making their pledge, especially if they're seeking re-election, to be sure to follow the straight line, so to speak. But also, too, you have the next in command that have to really do it, because they may have to supervise the people below him or her to make sure that the ethics rules are followed.
Absolutely. And we find that there's, you know, up until the last 5-8 years, ethics has not really been promoted within municipalities like it has been more recently. And we see there's good reason for that with some of the indictments that have come down over time.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did U.S. Attorney Tom Kirsch have to say in addressing all of you at the latest Ethics Summit here, and certainly in light of the atmosphere that we are all living in these days, in not exactly very pleasant times, politically or morally, I imagine, too?
Well, correct. And, you know, one thing that he talked about is his office, what they do, covert, overt operations that they perform. And one of the key takeaways that I got out of it personally was that he said, when we investigate somebody, and we try to do this without anybody knowing it, because a lot of times people that are investigated and it goes public, their lives are ruined. And I really hadn't really thought that far into things, but it was interesting to hear him say that with all of the indictments that have come down in Northwest Indiana between Lake and Porter counties, that there's been a lot in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, and it's still happening. And so are people not getting the message that you have a moral obligation to do things openly and honestly for the electorate? I mean, you're representing the people. You were elected by the people. Their expectation is that you're going to do things properly, and that doesn't always happen, as we know.
What else did he happen to add, I guess, along those lines? Because obviously he's not going to be able to talk about ongoing cases, because that's not allowed, but the idea is that he knows, and his people in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Hammond and I guess the other areas in South Bend and Fort Wayne in particular, in the district that he covers, they know what's going on, and they know what needs to be done.
That they do, and like I said earlier, you know, there's so much stuff happening that if he's bringing something forward for prosecution, he wants to make sure they're utilizing all their resources appropriately, and they're not going to bring something forward unless they feel they have a pretty solid case.
Did he be able to spend some time in his remarks at the Ethics Summit, not only talking about what you've already mentioned here, but taking a look, maybe some of his own reflections on some of the past cases here, and how we can, because it's the effort, I guess, is trying to look to the future and how to prevent these problems from happening. Did he happen to mention anything in particular?
Well, he did mention that, you know, the people or the citizens have a right, and sometimes they might need to step up and voice their expectations publicly at a meeting, things like that, to let the mayors or the town council or whoever it might be, clerk treasurers, you know, this is what their expectation is, and you know, to, I don't want to say call them on the carpet, but to let them know that people are watching and they need to do the right thing.
So it's not only the media and the like that are keeping an eye on them, but it's the citizenry as well, the people that these folks work for, technically.
It was interesting because he took questions from the audience as well, and that's when there was really a lot of audience engagement, and some of the questions that he was asked, of course, he could not answer because he said, hey, I don't know, so I'm not going to say something I'm not sure of. But one interesting point that he made in the Q&A was that he saw that our summit was supported by NIPSCO and by Unity Foundation. Anyway, he said, if I come here and eat breakfast that might have been paid for by NIPSCO, what does that say about me? Is that something I do? I not do? And he did not come for breakfast. He came, gave his talk, and he left.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, I don't want to give people, the wrong idea that hey, I'm because NIPSCO bought me breakfast, I'm going to give them favor. And he says he's very watchful to make sure that things like that don't happen, or that people don't think that he's taking something from someone for a favor down the road.
Well, it sounds like that certainly the Thomas Kirsch obviously knows his role in the process, to be sure, and he knows the importance of and being watched as closely as he is, and with all the publicity that he's picked up just by the fact that he's the U.S. attorney in Northern Indiana, that he has to be careful about these things, to be sure. It sounds like it was a great speech that he gave and some great advice that he's offered everybody, and it looks like the 2019 Ethics Summit got the year, at least for this election year, off to a good start for getting the information out and trying to get more organizations is within governments, the right to be sure they know their rules, the ethics rules are followed, and they're ready to go for the terms of office that they may or may not get to serve.
Absolutely. And this was one of the biggest summits we've ever had. We had just under 300 people at this event.
Oh, my goodness.
Which was huge. And I think it's because of Tom Kirsch being our keynote speaker. And he was an excellent person to have. And people wanted to come hear what he had to say.
Well, Dan, thanks for spending time with us and talking about what he did have to say at the recent Ethics Summit. And tell us, too, what the Shared Ethics Advisory Commission has planned as we go into this municipal election year. And I'll be watching very closely to see what our proposed elected officials and those who are seeking office once again will do to follow the rules properly.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Later this week at Purdue University Northwest on the Westville campus, we're going to bring attention to the issue of human trafficking across Indiana with a look locally as well, too, here in the region. And for the news about this conference, which is a one-day affair coming up, we're going to talk with Purdue University Northwest and Westville campus, Assistant Professor of Behavioral Sciences and the Program Director of Social Work on campus, Pamela Saylor. And we have two students as well with us, Sage Santana and Haley Hardesty. And thank you all for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris, for inviting us. Thank you.
Well, let's take a look first here at the issue of human trafficking. It's been brought up several times in other conferences, and I'm sure this will be the latest information that will come out here about the problem. How does the situation, sadly, stand with human trafficking here in Northwest Indiana these days?
In Northwest Indiana, so far in the year, well, going back to the year 2018, there were a total of 152 reported cases made in the state as a whole, and 59 cases were reported and investigated after that. However, the amount of total victims is roughly between 650 to 700, which is relatively high in the scope of things. Northwest Indiana particularly has been identified as a hub for human trafficking, specifically because it's so close to Chicago. Specifically in the Porter County, there has been a lot of attention drawn by the police forces to try and tackle this issue because it's been so prevalent.
Mm-hmm. I know even in Lake County, the latest instance we have that is probably a suspected case. I'm not sure if it has been completely investigated to be confirmed, but there's probably some suspected cases of human trafficking where have involved some massage parlors that have been
yeah.
shut down
mm-hmm.
in Highland. And the people involved in those who came from China eventually will probably
yeah.
face charges, and that may come into a Northwest Indiana a human trafficking case there too, I imagine.
Yeah.
With this very serious problem of human trafficking in Northwest Indiana, and part of the conference is coming up on Thursday that will go into more detail. We have luckily some survivors who have managed to get out. Is it easy? And apparently it must not be easy for people who are involved in human trafficking to get out of the situation that they're in, get some help, and in turn become regular citizens, so to speak.
Yeah, it is. And we're finding that, you know, the survivors that we do come in contact, they really are those strong advocates that really want to bring awareness to those issues. So for the conference, we have two survivors. One is a labor survivor, and then the other one is a sex survivor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're trying to bring the survivors to the conference, and then also the professionals that are working with survivors to increase that awareness. And, you know, how do we recognize those red flags? And then what can we do to advocate for survivors?
In a little bit here, let's go into more detail about some of the participants in the conference coming up there on the Westville campus. That does bring up a question that I have. Do we find that more of the people who unfortunately have gotten involved in human trafficking end up in the sex worker trade as opposed to being in forced labor, like you mentioned that one instance that we'll hear more about later this week?
Yes. So specifically, again, in Indiana and generally, as a rule of thumb, sex trafficking tends to be the leading form of human trafficking,
mm-hmm.
And it beats out combined any other unspecified type of human trafficking or labor trafficking combined. So sex trafficking truly is the major form of human trafficking.
Yeah. The conference, one-day conference, is entitled Human Trafficking, Elevating Awareness, Recovery, and Prevention, and it's open to the public. Folks here at Northwest Indiana will have a chance to sit in and listen and find out more and learn more about this. It's being hosted by Purdue University Northwest Social Work Program, and that's why we have Professor Pamela Saylor and students Sage Santana and Haley Hardesty with us to talk about this. It's going to happen on Thursday, April 11th. It's going to start at 8 o'clock in the morning and run to about 4 o'clock, 3:45 in the afternoon. It's going to be held in the James Dworkin Student Services and Activities Complex on the Purdue University Northwest Westville campus. And let's all go through the schedule now here. You mentioned after the usual welcomes and the like, it'll start the morning off here. We're going to hear some stories from the survivors. Tell us about the two people that you have scheduled to be at the conference and to talk specifically about their problems.
So our schedule starts off with registration. We're going to do an introduction and welcome, and then we're going to introduce our first survivor, mm-hmm. Katie Roach, at 8:45, and she's going to speak to us till about 9:30. And then we are going to have our second survivor,
Kebby Kayzera.
Uh-huh.
She's going to speak with us for another 45 minutes.
I do want to interject just a little bit. Katie Roach, they are going to do poetry for their presentation. And then Kebby Kayzera was a labor trafficked in at IU Bloomington. So they both have these very interesting stories to share with our participants at the conference that morning. Okay.
Well, tell us a little bit about Katie Roche. What did Katie get involved in or was aware of in the problem of human trafficking?
Part of it was hers involved family. And this is very common that people that are trafficked, they have family that are involved that will tell them stories of, you know, I have a job for you, or I want you to meet up with so-and-so. And so they're trafficked that way. And so actually both of our speakers this morning will be talking about how they were trafficked by family members.
Yeah, yeah. And I imagine that in many cases, if not most of them, the ones that are involved in human trafficking that come from China, from the Far East, that may be the case mostly?
Yes, that is correct. Tebby, I'm not quite sure where she came from, but she's from a different country.
Yeah. So I understand. Yeah, I understand
that. That is quite common.
She's from South Africa, and I guess her family. You say she was lied to and tricked to by family to be involved in the trade, and that's how she ended up in Bloomington, Indiana. What did she?
Yeah,
what'd she end up doing down there?
She actually was. She stayed at somebody's home while they attended school, and mm-hmm. so she eventually got out, and now she's working different jobs to get her degree.
That's great. So we hear from the two survivors first thing in the morning when the conference gets underway. And how does the rest of the morning shape out before the midday break?
So we're actually going to have two breakout sessions. The first one is a survivor-centered approach to victim advocacy, case management, and referrals. And that's going to be presented by Kate Kimmer. And our second session is going to run from about 11:45 to 1. And that's going to be during our lunch. She's going to be a keynote speaker. Mm-hmm. And that's Laura Ng. She's going to talk about the importance of mending micro and macro practice. And she's from Traffic Free.
So, and Laura Ng, I do want to mention, she's the executive director for Traffic Free, also teaches at Jane Addams in Chicago. And so she started this agency several years back to increase that awareness to the Chicagoland area. So the speakers that we have are strong professionals and advocates working with survivors, increasing that awareness getting the word out and doing a lot of advocacy in the Chicagoland, Indiana areas.
That's right. We're talking with Purdue University Northwest Westville Campus Professor Pamela Saylor and two of her students, Sage Santana and Haley Hardesty. And we're talking about the upcoming Human Trafficking, Elevating Awareness, Recovery, and Prevention. It's a day-long conference open to the public, and it's going to be hosted on the Purdue University Northwest campus in Westville by the university's social work program. And we've talked here about the sessions and some of the experts are going to be talking here. We have the victims in human trafficking, I'm sure, are going to be heard from in one way or the other. And I understand that's how the rest of the session goes. Tell us about that.
The afternoon will start with empowering and serving victims. Our speaker for that is Manette Valentine. And then we have another speaker, Shalini Murpuri. Mm-hmm. She's going to be talking about sex trafficking and commercial sexual exploitation. And then we're going to wrap up our day with bringing back Katie Roche and a few of our PNW social work students. And we're just going to discuss the day and elevate the awareness.
Now, I know this is primarily a session, it's open to the public, or at least that's the way it's being set up, but obviously you students are going to benefit as well from much of this. Have you got all of this lined up in part of your coursework that you do at Purdue Northwest this semester?
Well, Chris, you know, I really want to put a shout-out to our social work students. Mm-hmm. This is actually a macro practice social work class, and so the students are actually coordinating this event. And they're speaking at the event, and they've coordinated. And I'm actually very proud of them right now, because this is a student-led conference, which is a day conference open to the community. We also have continuing ed for licensed social workers. So it's going to be a wonderful event, I believe very impactful for our students as they go out into the field and understanding how this affects clients that they'll be serving in the community. And then it'll be a great community event to bring awareness to these issues that face our community as a whole, and just an impactful experience for everyone that attends.
I know in many cases, many of these sessions that are held dealing with human trafficking and enlightenment, to be sure, usually talk, as we say, more about victims. They don't always focus in like this one-day conference is to talk about ways to help resolve the issues and as well as enlighten people on what the problems are and how to help deal with it, too. Now, if anybody has any more questions about the session itself coming up on Thursday the 11th, for costs or anything like that, or make sure they're available, be able to let you all know that they'd like to come to the event, how can they get hold of you folks?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm going to give you the link to our registration and the event, and it's pnw.edu/social-work, and that'll bring you directly to the website for the conference. I will say that if people are going to register, they need to register quickly, because our registration, we're getting up there in numbers, and it looks, you know, which is great for the event. I also wanted to mention, too, that I've received some emails from community members of how they can be a part of this process and what can we do for the future. So I do see this as bringing awareness to the community, but also for those people that are interested, how can they get involved? I also want to mention that this event is free for students, and I want to say high school, college are multiple universities that are in our region. Students are free for this event. Community members are $20. So it's a great event for students that might be interested in learning more about human trafficking.
And it sounds like the $20 cost is basically to cover some of the costs of perhaps the midday
lunch
and things like that, right?
A very light continental breakfast and lunch.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
It's a great deal, Chris.
Well, Professor Saylor and Sage and Haley, it sounds like it's going to be a great session that you all are working on the Purdue University Northwest Westfield campus. And we hope that the citizens, as well as those people involved in the issue of human trafficking, will have a chance to attend, learn more about it. We've been talking with Purdue University Northwest Assistant Professor of Behavioral Sciences and the Program Director of Social Work, Pamela Saylor. And we have two of Pamela's students, Sage Santana and Haley Hardesty, with us to talk about this special one-day conference coming up on Thursday the 11th, which is entitled Human Trafficking, Elevating Awareness, Recovery, and Prevention. And ladies, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate your having a chance to talk with us today and not only enlighten people about the one-day conference coming up, but about the issue of human trafficking here in Northwest Indiana. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Chris.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A bill moving through the General Assembly that has public library directors across Indiana very worried. It's a measure that could, if it's enacted into law, shift control of library budgets from library boards over to town, city, or county councils. Ingrid Norris, the executive director and CEO of the Lake County Public Library, was on Regionally Speaking to explain the local impact of the bill if it became law. She starts out by explaining the difference between local government finances and the public library finances when it comes to big projects.
The public library is not allowed to levy for, say, a capital improvements money. So the libraries have both a rainy day fund and then they have a library improvement reserve fund. To be able to fund those, we actually have to be frugal. And mm-hmm. we have to, at the end of the year, whatever money we are able to transfer that money to one of these two funds. Then if we need to, for example, I have 9 buildings. So there's HVAC systems, there's repairs. That money comes from the money that we have saved over the years to fund those. Every other government entity, schools, county, police departments, you know, all of those entities have a CUME fund, which means they can actually levy taxpayers or assess taxpayers' money to be able to fund those. We have to, in general, have to be frugal so that we can save basically for rainy days.
Now, going back in time, when the Lake County Public Library System decided that they needed to expand the Central Library in Merrillville and add on the space, there were just not enough shelves, space for all the books and other items that were there, and do some shifting around. How did that major project get funded?
We actually went out for a bond and went through the whole legal process, and we received a $30 million bond, and we built new buildings. We renovated all the other buildings, and actually, because of the tax caps, we refinanced that bond so that we could pay off early the bond, so it wouldn't. When the tax caps in Lake County take effect, Lake County Library will only have one more bond payment in 2020.
Wow.
We specifically did that so that, because we knew that was going to come under the tax caps, and so we felt it was fiscally responsible for us to do. So we double paid the bond a couple of years, and then we also refinanced to a lower rate. So that is because of Larry Acheff, our former director, that he realized, he looked to the future and decided it was the best. So our bond is actually going to be falling away in 2020, and that's because of the work that we did.
Now, how do you think the Lake County Public Library System fares in that respect compared maybe to others around the state in other cities like Fort Wayne or South Bend or Indianapolis even, with maybe the same kind of debt load that they're going to have to deal with?
Well, actually, for us, we don't know how it's going to fare because we overlap 41 other entities. So all the debt that is with those other entities will impact our budget because with the tax caps, there's only so much money. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know how we're going to be. We think we may lose $1 million in our budget just because of all the other debt that is still out there in Lake County. So all we just have to wait till 2020 and see.
And find out. And that's, unfortunately, that puts you, I guess, in the same boat as the towns and the cities, the townships in particular, and all the public school districts out there, too. They're waiting to find out what impact the dropping of the circuit breaker for Lake County is going to have here now. In looking at this measure, and we should mention, too, that if you want to look it up and find out more, the bill probably itself doesn't tell you much, but the bill is entitled House Bill 1343. And it is now, as we said, it's in the Senate. It's made it over to the Senate. In fact, the Senate Local Government Committee had the hearing last Thursday in Indianapolis that you and a number of your colleagues attended to talk to the lawmakers on committee about. With this intent of trying to find a way to restructure library budgets so that they would come under the supervision, however you want to put it, of a town or city or a county council, do you think that maybe there are some library districts or library operations elsewhere in the state that might be in worse shape, and in turn they were the ones that might be, that was the intent of the people that are drafting the measure to bring them under control?
Well, I think there is a little bit of a misunderstanding because the library that actually triggered it did have a cash reserve, and so they specifically lowered the amount of money they were collecting from other from the taxpayers to pay down that or to use the reserve. And once they had brought it down to a reasonable level, they went back to their allowed tax levy. So if you look at, you know, the what it looks like on the internet or on Gateway, which is the thing, it appears like they dramatically increased their budget. They didn't. They just went back to their original, what they were allowed. So, but there are other libraries. I think I have a good relationship. We have a good relationship with county government. I think the other libraries are concerned because there's an inherent bias that the ones that could profit from reducing a library budget, because they would obviously get more money, they're going to be the ones that will be able to decide. And the way it's written now is up to 10% a year annually. In 10 years, we could be at 25% of our budget.
I guess there are concerns, and maybe not necessarily in Lake County's case, but some county out there with a very ambitious city council or a county council will take a look at this paperwork, see how the budget is structured, and they'll sit and kind of smack their lips, especially if they see a big number in that reserve fund in particular. But there may have been a reason for that particular library system. Make sure that number is in there, because they've got some big work that'll have to be done eventually. And because we've done all of our big work earlier, we don't have that much problem to worry about these days now.
I think that's a good synopsis of the problem, that we're doing fine in Lake County. Our board is engaged. I think part of the problem is, too, is they believe that because it's an appointed board, they shouldn't have the authority to levy or ask for taxpayer money. But I think that's a slippery slope, because there are other appointed boards that manage money. And if you go down this path, that could be at risk if this bill goes through, because it's appointed boards. There's a reason for appointed boards.
Now, Ingrid Norris was one of the representatives of public school districts that was at that committee hearing in Indianapolis. And the latest information that we can find from the General Assembly on House Bill 1343 is that on Monday, April 1st, last Monday, the committee report had come out and it was amended to pass and was adopted. Nothing else, though, has been noticed as far as any other movement on the measure in the Indiana Senate. It's time for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Scott McDonald, who is the executive director of the beautiful Memorial Opera House in downtown Valparaiso. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Nice to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
And you have shows all year round.
Yes.
And many shows.
It's, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you're really busy over
there. Yes, yes. Five main stage shows, several lunchtime cabarets. Our children's theater program is growing. The Limelight's our youth program. It has 20 classes that they're working through this year. So it's really, really exciting.
How many paid staff members do you have?
Let's see. I have three full-time staff. That includes myself, my administrative coordinator, and my technical director. And then we have about 10 that are part-time. And that ranges from, like, part-time meaning, like, you know, 25 hours a week to, like, you know, whenever you can come in.
I see.
And several contractors.
Yeah.
We have a lot of contractors that work for us.
So you're going to be doing La Cage aux Folles.
Yes.
One of my favorites.
Same.
It's such a fun... I can't think of the composer's name. He did Hello...
Jerry Herman.
Jerry Herman, of course. Hello, Dolly.
Yes. MAME. Dear World. You know, Land of Milk and Honey and Mac and Mabel.
Mac and Mabel. So La Cage aux Folles is it from the 70s?
1983.
Oh, that late.
Yeah.
I'm surprised.
Yeah.
Okay. And I see that, I see you mentioned that it's held up for over 30 years.
Yes, it really has. I think to paraphrase Jerry Herman's Tony acceptance speech for La Cage, he set out to write a show that proved that the kind of classic show tune that's hummable and simple still held its place in American theater in the 1980s when we were looking at things like Sunday in the Park with George and some of these really complicated pieces. This is such a simple, lovely piece.
Yeah.
And
it's true.
It doesn't feel like a period piece or dated or anything like that, even 30 years later.
So it is based on the movie was called The Birdcage.
Yes.
So La Cage aux Folles is based on a French story.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us about it?
So Jean Perrault wrote the the story in the 1970s and the play La Cage aux Folles, and it's about a gay couple who own a nightclub and their son is engaged to a lovely young woman whose parents are extremely conservative and guess who's coming to dinner? The girl and her parents. And so it's the typical kind of comedy along the lines of You Can't Take It With You, where, you know, there's this family that kind of appears to be completely insane and everything's going to be spoiled and ruined because the conservative family is going to hate who you really are. So let's change everything about who you are.
And there's a certain amount of cross-dressing involved.
There's a lot of drag involved in the show. Our one of the main characters in the central couple, Alban, is also Zaza, who is the headlining drag queen at La Cage aux Folles.
And has to kind of matron himself.
Matron, yes. Become mother.
Become mother.
Yes. So.
Very hilarious.
Yes.
Is
great comedy of errors.
Is the father a senator? Or was that just
the conservative
movie?
Father? He is in the play. He is a deputy of the Tradition, Family, and Morality Party.
Okay,
so yeah, it sounds familiar.
Yes, and it was Robin Williams.
Robin Williams, Nathan Lane.
Nathan Lane, yeah.
Yep, and then Gene Hackman and Diane Wiest were the conservative parents.
That was fun. I remember it was kind of controversial when it first came
out
because it was very it was very much a caricature of the gay character.
Yes.
But I did not take offense at it. I thought it was quite fun.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought it was loads of fun. And I saw the revival on Broadway, the most recent one. And I can't remember the actor's name who won for Zaza.
Douglas Hoche.
Exactly.
Yes.
Magnificent.
Wonderful. And then he appears in things like Penny Dreadful on Netflix, where he's the complete opposite character.
Yeah, he was a fantastic actor in that. So who's directing this show?
I am.
Oh, I was hoping that's what you would say.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's one of my favorites. I actually did the show 17 years ago. I played Jean-Michel, the son. And it's one of those shows that I just really wanted to make happen. Yeah. And it finally was time to bring it to the Opera House. And we just cast it. We have a cast of 15, and we are over the moon.
So when is it on?
We open up April 26th and run for 3 weekends through May 12th.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So lots of opportunity to come out to Valpo on a nice evening and see this show. And what are your ticket prices?
Tickets are $21 for adults, $18 for students and seniors, and can be purchased online at memorialoperahouse.com. Or through our box office at 219-548-9137.
Well, fantastic. And just quickly about your cast. Is that local people?
Yes, it is all local volunteers. We've had a couple people from Chicago come in to do the show. And we are very, very excited. But people from all over the region.
Great.
So,
wonderful. Well, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, Scott, for being here to tell us about La Cage aux Folles at Memorial Opera House. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we hope that you'll be with us tomorrow.